Hello and welcome to episode 18 of the Mostly Erlang podcast. Today we are joined by Alex Gunaris of Concurix. Alex, could you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about your company?
I'd be happy to. Thank you very much, Zach, and thank you everybody in the audience for listening. We're delighted to be here. My name is Alex Gunaris, as Zach said. I'm the CEO of Concurix Corporation. And we build a suite of big data-driven development tools for Erlang and Node.js. So these are real-time visual profilers and debuggers. And what we've focused on doing is building tools that help developers understand what is going on in very large and complex code bases. If you think about sort of the existing state of the art, you have tools like New Relic and other monitoring systems, which are fabulous for kind of keeping track of what's going on with your system at a very high level. Did this URL or this website respond in a timely manner? And then, of course, you have your traditional low-level tools like GProf or Visual Studio, which can really tell you a lot about what's going on a line-by-line basis. And what we found is the missing opportunity that we're working really hard on is that middle space between the two. When you have a very large complex system that might have millions of lines of code, how do you understand what all is happening? And the remarkable thing in today's software is you might think, oh, well, I don't really have a million lines of code. And that could be true. But if you take even a very simple program, like a Hello World program in Node.js, that can be 250,000 lines of code right there. And then similar phenomena happens in Erlang as well. And it's not code that you wrote. It's all these third-party modules. There's all these amazing libraries for the Amazon SDK or Daily Cred to go connect up to an authentication system, or CouchDB or React or pick your favorite thing. There's a ton of great third-party modules out there. And by the time you include all these things into your program, you've got a very, very complex system that can behave in unexpected ways.
Instead of pick your favorite thing, we also, it's pick your 20 favorite things.
Exactly. So that's what we've built, a set of tools to help developers kind of understand what's going on. We've had remarkable success with these. We've just launched in market in the last couple months. So we're still pretty early, but we've now surpassed 12 million usages of our products. And we've seen customers get as high as a 40x speed improvement using our tools. So we're very excited about what's going on and look forward to working with everybody and helping them out with their projects and getting good feedback and making even better tools. Lots more we can talk about, but that's the high level.
We also have Fred Haber. Fred, give yourself the brief introduction for those who haven't listened.
So, hi, I'm Fred. I wrote the book Learn Use Erlang for Great Good. And lately, I've been working at Heroku in their routing team and writing blog posts and being angry on Twitter and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, that's what I do.
Angry on Twitter, always appropriate.
Yeah, always.
Well, I do want to give a shout out then to your book, Fred. The Learn Use of Erlang for Great Good is a fabulous, fabulous resource for learning Erlang. I had the great pleasure of reading many of your early articles when I was just out on the web. That's how I learned some of the finer points of OTP. So thank you very much, Fred.
Thanks.
Yeah, actually, I got to say, I work. I'm the back end team for a small startup here in Tel Aviv, and we have not implemented your product yet because we're sort of in the just launching phase. But I'm looking forward to doing so at some point in the future when we actually.
Excellent.
I mean, the thing is right now our load is basically we're doing, three concurrent requests at any given instant usually, so.
Okay, well, yeah.
We don't really need it yet.
You've got a lot of headroom still, so.
Yeah, and our API is basically built using Web Machine, and there's a Raya core and some other stuff behind it. And my own monitoring, which is basically just the Raya performance log, or the Web Machine performance logs piped through R.
And then you do some analysis using R.
Yeah, I love R. I discovered it recently, yeah. And it's great. Actually, speaking of R, today is, at least when we're recording, International Talk Like a Pirate Day. So, thought I'd throw that out there.
We already had that discussion over here in the office, and actually here in the States, Krispy Kreme is offering a free donut if you talk like a pirate. So, We were debating, do we take the company field trip down to Krispy Kreme and go get ourselves donuts?
I hope you do.
well, we decided not to because we wanted to do this conversation with everybody here.
Okay.
But actually, if I may, maybe a good segue would be to pick up on your comment about three transactions a second.
Transactions at a time, I said. No, I mean, transaction. The point at which I start looking at things and going, wow, that's going really slow on our API is 10 milliseconds. Anything that has a performance either on average above 10 milliseconds or if one standard deviation is above about 25, I start going, why is that so slow? I need to do something about it, or at least a ticket gets generated in, you know, Pivotal Tracker and I come back to it later. But no, it's only three three are happening. If three are happening at once right now, that's a lot for us because we're just, you know, very early.
Got it.
And we just only have a few customers. Hopefully that'll change.
So I hope so. But you know, every company starts somewhere. So, and that's a good spot to start. But the thing I wanted to pick up on though was, in a sense, it's not too early to start thinking about what I'll call the architecture for performance. And let me describe it this way. The thing that really matters is your ability to scale. And this is a little bit different than, say, whether a particular API can respond in 10 milliseconds or 11 milliseconds or what have you. One of the things that we found with Erlang and similarly with Node.js is that even though Erlang on kind of a, on a apples-to-apples benchmark, single thread of execution, it's pretty pokey. You know, if you go look at the various benchmark stats, and I apologize, I don't recall the name, the sort of popular one right off the top of my head. Erlang is kind of slow. Again, just sort of like if you look at the compilation speed of a small program like a Mandelbrot set or what have you. But what happens is if you can get it to scale across a modern many-core system, then you can actually go really, really fast. One of the prototypes that we built here at Concurix, just to sort of understand this, was an image processing prototype. And we were working with a customer that wanted to do basically grab all the images coming off the web in real time, decode them, geotag them, and put them into an in-memory database.
Cool.
My apologies, I can't say more about that particular company. They're still in stealth, and we have some agreements with them. But very, very cool effort. But just to sort of calibrate, Facebook has published a number where they say they get 300 million photos a day. So let's take that 300 million photos a day as kind of the benchmark. Now, if I told somebody just sort of who understood Erlang that I wanted to do image processing in Erlang, they might think I'm a little nuts, because Erlang is not particularly fast at floating point, and there's all these great GPU driven libraries for image processing. Well, we did it anyway. We went ahead and wrote a user mode Erlang-based PNG decoder that would open up images, decode them, scale them, and then extract out the geotag information and put it into an in-memory database. And in our case, we used Amnesia. We were able to get the equivalent of 300 million photos a day on just 17 servers. And this is all user mode Erlang without any GPU assist or anything like that. Now, the trick to getting that kind of scale on 17 servers was that we were using 64-core servers. And these are commodity servers. It's actually the number one selling server in the world. Blade server, 1U unit, 64 cores from Supermicro, costs about $5,000. So the point I wanted to get here is you can achieve Facebook scale very inexpensively if your software can scale.
Right, I'm sure doing the
and if you can't scale,
in my head, man, about $70,000-$80,000 worth of servers plus some network equipment. So you probably figure about $80,000 for the server rack.
It actually works out a little closer to about $100,000 by the time you really put in the appropriate network gear to handle that kind of load. But And obviously, you know, your mileage may vary because, you know, this was a lab prototype. So if you added more features, things would go slower. But we didn't spend any time doing any particular optimization. So obviously, you can make it go faster by putting more engineering effort into it. So the point isn't to focus so much on 17 servers. The point was more to illustrate that, you know, a modern server is actually a very, very capable beast. But if you run afoul of Amdahl's law and you start having code that blocks on itself or has contention, then all the sort of traditional optimizations that you might do are, you know, completely wasted. It's maybe too strong to say that, but they aren't as effective simply because you've got blocks in your application. And so when you think about it from an Erlang perspective, the thing to really pay attention to is, in particular, how you're using OTP. You know, OTP is a wonderful framework, particularly for reliability. But if you overuse it and you have too many singleton gen servers, each of those singleton gen servers can become a point of bottlenecking and point of contention.
Right. I've noticed that on our own app that we certainly have some, but I sort of keep an eye on them because they are obviously the place where things can, you know, start serializing on you. And I'm trying to move as many of them out into other types of services as I can.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the kind of thing where we're in a little bit long-winded way, but if you start thinking about, you know, just from day one, even when you're, you know, lower scale and just beginning, you know, designing your system such that it has inherent scalability in it and thinking about where are those choke points, that'll save you a lot of grief down the road.
Yeah, Fred, do you have any, I mean, at Heroku, you're at Heroku, so I assume you guys see some pretty massive load on occasion too. So do you have anything you can throw in about this?
The approach we have is more I/O bound than image processing is. But one of the very interesting points that we have regarding Erlang is that you have this kind of decoupling that you see in service-oriented architecture, right? And when you do service-oriented architecture, you have different servers and you communicate over sockets and message passing, and you basically get the same thing that Erlang gives you, but you have the overhead of communicating across machine boundaries or language boundaries through more expensive serialization protocols. And something that happens when you design a service with Erlang on a single node is that you're able to get that kind of decoupling where you can run applications independently, restart them, or upgrade them independently as the entire stack keeps running, and isolating their errors outside of what is basically hardware errors without having all the usual overhead and architecture that's required. And so this is something that I think never shows up in benchmarks, but is ultimately very, very interesting when you're building something usable for people. You have to take to consider all these things that you have to do to monitor applications, restart them, manage them, have them communicate, and the fact that you can do that locally in a single Erlang node if you're just getting started and eventually able to distribute it without all the overhead of doing it all by HTTP or whatever protocol you're using within the single node boundary. And that turns out to be, actually, we don't have really numbers to compare that, but it turns out that we feel that it's giving you a lot of advantages when it comes to really being in production and handling a serious load compared to doing it with a system that's been assembled with many independent components that then communicate in entirely separate ways. Because when you get to debugging these distributed systems that cannot communicate in the same way, you have to do them all individually, but doing it within a single Erlang virtual machine, you're able to do it at a single prompt with all the same kind of language for everything, the same kind of tooling for everything. And so you get a lot of stuff free regarding that, both in terms of performance and maintenance costs. So that's fairly interesting, and that's something that, yeah, never really shows up in benchmarks, I think.
Yeah, very well said. I totally agree.
I'm curious. Obviously, you guys are doing Erlang and Node.js. Why did you, sort of decide to do those two instead of Java, which seems like it would be sort of an obvious point where a lot of people are using it? Is it just Java doesn't support the kind of monitoring you want to do easily, or is it just there's other tools, or you just didn't want to deal with the JVM, which I
totally... Let me... Let me make sure I understood your question. So your question is, why do we expand out to Node.js?
Yeah, I mean,
as the next market?
Yeah, not Ruby or Java or something.
So we, maybe a little bit of history for folks. We started in Erlang, and our thesis was, we actually started the company focused on a mini core operating system. You know, really trying to understand how to exploit the power of today's modern servers. And so Erlang was a very natural technical choice.
Right.
And you know, we're very, very happy with the Erlang work, and it's a, you know, it's a fabulous environment. But you know, but it is a smaller market. And so as we grew the company, we were looking for the next big market to tackle. And we did look at Java, Ruby Rails, Python, you know, PHP, and similar languages quite extensively. And we ended up picking Node.js for a couple of reasons. The first is Node.js is a very, very interesting and clever framework and environment. It's actually a functional language and a functional programming environment. When you look at sort of the heart of JavaScript, and for those folks that don't know Node.js, Node.js is JavaScript on the server. So JavaScript is kind of a, as a whole, it's a very ugly language because it's sort of designed by committee over many years. But the core of it is essentially Scheme. It's a functional language on the inside.
No, I know. I rather like JavaScript. Actually, I like CoffeeScript more. You know, it's just the thing I just like about Node.js is it makes you do everything in a callback, and this just don't compose very well. And yes, you can play with futures, and it's kind of very sugary. Its Scheme heritage shows through, and it's a very sugary language. But you know, it just seems run everything in a single process in a modern, 24-core server seems like a very silly design decision. But maybe there's stuff about it.
Well, there's some stuff about it, and that's one of the. So when we first started the company, we looked at Node.js, and you know, that single core, single process limitation was one of the reasons why we did not go with Node.js at the time. But the community and the project has evolved significantly over the last 2 years. And they now do a very, very good job supporting multi-core machines. And so in essence, what's happened with Node.js is they've taken a lot of the really good ideas of Erlang, where you really focus on, essentially, functional, or the unit of execution, if you will, is a functional unit. And you try to do message passing between sort of your big areas of independent execution. And just in the Node.js world, that's called clusters and async callbacks and closures. And obviously in Erlang, it's called processes and messages. But from a design perspective, the model of Node.js matched very well with some of the algorithms and mathematics that we were doing over here at Concurrix. So technically, it made a lot of sense. And then from a market size, Node.js has simply exploded. They're now doing some 95 million downloads a month of third-party modules.
Wow!
So it is over this last year, it literally is just taking off like crazy. Even as early as this fall, earlier this spring, it was only around 30 million downloads a month, and now they're up to 90 million downloads a month. So it's a model where it has a lot of the nice attributes of Erlang. But all the crazy JavaScript stuff that people have done over the years for web browsers, all those libraries are available. So the depth of sort of third-party module support is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, JavaScript is a language that I wrote a book on it, basically, HTML5 JavaScript.
Oh, excellent.
And I've mostly gotten away from it because it's a language that has some really nice parts that I really like. And then I feel like it just has too many landmines in it. That even if you were in JavaScript, JS Lint, or
there's this classic picture of JavaScript the good parts compared right next to the book Integral JavaScript or Complete JavaScript Reference, and the good parts is not even a tenth of the big book when you compare it to pictures. So
and honestly, JavaScript the good parts has all these railroad syntax diagrams, which I don't quite understand why they need to be there. They seem like kind of superfluous, but apparently Douglas Crawford likes them, so he put them in. So JavaScript, yeah. I mean, honestly, as languages go, it could be a hell of a lot worse. I mean, it could be Java.
That's faint praise.
It could be PHP. I just find that the callback structure, everything has to be a callback. You end up into, you know, sort of spaghetti hell, and I kind of feel like Node.js callbacks are to 2013 what basic line number go-tos were to, you know, 1983. And it's the callbacks considered harmful when overused. And I'm sure...
Yeah, no, they absolutely can.
Hate tweets about that one, but that's okay. I can deal with that.
Well, no, it absolutely is fair that you can get yourself into callback hell. And thanks for sending along that link to the two different JavaScript books. That will now be my vote for my favorite picture of the day. That is awesome. So the thing I would say, just maybe for any listeners that are working in Node.js as well as Erlang or what have you, definitely read Crockford and the JavaScript, the good parts. Learn it and treat that as your definitive reference. Don't get into all the other crazy stuff.
Or better yet, JavaScript.
Even better. And then in terms of callbacks, there's a wonderful library from Colin called Async. And if you use the Async library, it actually makes a lot of that stuff, a lot of the callback hell, a lot more more manageable.
We don't use Node.js at our company, but we do use a lot of JavaScript at the front end, obviously, which I don't thankfully write. Somebody else does. We use at least for a while, we were using the Q library, which is a promises library as well. Which you know, basically gives you promises, basically a monad.
Very good.
And I'm a big...
I've not used that particular library, but there's a few of them. So, you know, I do hope that the Node.js community at some point, you know, picks one of these libraries and adopts it into the core. Because what a number of these libraries do, and again, I don't know Q very well, but Async and a few other ones we looked at, they basically make the programmer or allow them to specify the fundamental pattern of asynchronous behavior. Do you want to do things in parallel? Is it a series? Is it a waterfall? And so forth. And when you end up writing your callbacks like that, it makes the code that previously was just inscrutable because you had 10 levels deep of callbacks into something that's really, really clear. It's like, oh, do these three things in parallel, then do this checkpoint, and then, you know, finally do the final, you know, you render the page and go.
Q gives you something similar where you have, you know, a monadic library and monads can compose, so you can do sort of the same thing, and you can separate the sequencing of operations from the operations themselves. So, Fred?
Yeah, there is this blog post, I don't remember, but I'm trying to find the link right now, that compared basically the equivalent of callbacks for concurrency to go-to to structured programming. It's basic form of concurrency you had back in the 70s and even before that. And it's basically, well, terrible compared to pretty much anything else you have. And people in Node.js or JavaScript or pretty much any framework that's callback-based will need some kind of library to structure all that information to make it higher level and easier to deal with. And when you get into languages like Mozart as a platform or Erlang or Clojure or whatever, they basically wrap all of these into language primitives that tend to make sense. Node.js made that decision. Well, people at Joliet, I think, made that decision that the core of Node.js is pretty much close to completion as far as they're concerned, and the rest is really just about the ecosystem and the libraries around. So I think it's really up to the people using it to pick one of these libraries as the bare minimum to do if you want to have decent or at least non-crappy concurrency experiences, I think.
You know, the thing is about Node.js, it seems to me they looked at the performance of Ruby on Rails and PHP and things like that and said, you know, the real problem is that Unix context switches are very heavy, that Unix processes are very heavy and that context switches are expensive. So we're going to avoid them at all costs by making the programmer do a lot of extra work, whereas Joe Armstrong and Robert Verding and those guys when they created Erlang said, we're going to simply make context switches and process operations incredibly cheap. So, you know, I mean, the problem is I was watching a video on the C10K problem, which was the C10M problem, which was, you know, how do you scale up Apache and web servers to do, you know, larger and larger scales? And the problem is with C10K is, you know, Apache... traditionally, I think the newer versions are a little better with this, relies on the Unix scheduler to switch off processes, and basically the processes that they're running are Unix processes. So every user gets a Unix process, which is, you know, a large, heavy, kind of blunt object. Whereas if you're, you know, our web server is running on, and our company's running on Milky Web with Web Machine, and, you know, I haven't profiled it to see how much memory each process uses, but I suspect by default it's, you know, 2 or 3 kilobytes or something, you know.
You'd be a lot less, because you need to have a whole virtual memory space just for one user.
So whatever it is, you know, but it's not very much. It hasn't been a problem yet. You know, even though we have some Riot Core stuff going on in the background, you know, it's still pretty light. You know, we'll see what it's like when we're getting, you know,
exactly
500 sites online for our service online and we're up and running and stuff. But
So I think there's, if I can build on some of these points, you know, there's definitely a lot to be said for the, you know, the Erlang programming model. But when you think about scale, to some of the points made earlier, this cluster module in Node.js has a very interesting pattern.
Where, describe it for those of us who are not familiar?
Certainly. So essentially the Node.js model for scaling is every core, every CPU core gets its own process. Okay. So within a process, you're doing the asynchronous callbacks, and every callback is a single-threaded single-threaded execution environment for JavaScript, which on a core is, you know, in a sense fine because the core is only really going to do one thing at a time anyway. And then they have essentially a very lightweight load balancer model where incoming network traffic would be sent to in sort of a round robin fashion would be sent to a process, you know. And every process is called a cluster. So there's a master process that does the load balancing and then worker processes. And what we found is that on a very large mini-core machine, on a 64-core machine, for example, the Node.js scaling model actually scales better than Erlang.
Oh, really?
Because and actually a lot better.
That doesn't necessarily surprise me, because you're going to do that thing where there's complete isolation between the cores. And either you're able to do all of the work individually on each single core, or you're doing something where you're pushing it to a third party where it's going to be a database that then becomes your contention point or whatever. And if you're doing it in Erlang, basically you still have that option to boot a VM per core, and that's how they did it, or we did it before 2009, I think, R13B, when they actually got decent SMP. And so when you do it with Erlang right now on 64 cores, then you get to have contention about the runtime system itself.
Exactly.
I don't doubt that Erlang is going to be faster if what you need to do is communicate between the individual actors, or if it were JavaScript callbacks within a node, because then you don't have the wall of going across process boundaries. But if what you're doing is completely isolated work that can be done within a single process that doesn't communicate with anything, then being completely isolated is going to be faster no matter what you do, because you don't have to have that contention for resources.
Exactly, very well said.
Also, there is...
And so the...
We, by the way, just for reference, a couple podcasts ago, we did one on the release project. It was the Megacore project podcast. I think it was episode number 14 with Hammond. And there's a several... The European Union has funded a project of to the tune of several million euro of how do you build... You know, how can you scale Erlang? You know, how do you solve this problem you're describing where, you know, how do you make Erlang scale to 64 cores or more likely, you know, 2,000 cores or something insane like that?
Right.
Which, you know, we don't have 2,000 core machines on our desks now. I have currently 8 cores between 2 physical computers on my desk, but I do not think it's going too far out on a limb to say that in 5 or 10 years, certainly servers, and I think even desktops could potentially be in the, you know, 1,000 core range. I think, I think 5-10 years from now we will be seeing that. I mean, I think even IBM has a IBM iSeries server that, as of a couple of years ago at least, that, you know, had 1,024 cores, power cores in it. I mean, it's probably cost you $1 million, but they had it. in the several million dollar range. I didn't really ask. It was kind of, you know, the built like a refrigerator kind of deal.
Well, you know the phrase, if you got to ask,
you can't afford it.
So maybe one way to boil down this discussion and to practical advice for any listeners I agree with a lot of the points you both of you raised, Red and Zach. I think the way to think of it is, if you're running on a many core system, try the SMP support in Erlang, and then also measure it against the just running a different Erlang process per core. And depending on the exact mix of how much stuff you're doing, where you have inter-process communication and so forth, you might, one of those would work better for you. But I think that's an area where the Erlang community maybe can borrow back, if you will, from the Node.js community.
That's possible. I mean, this is something that the Erlang community definitely used to do when the SMP implementation was so bad that it was much faster to run four of them and communicate over distribution channels than let the VM do its own scheduling instead. But the Erlang scheduling is getting better and better. And I think there's some value to just running a single machine and then reporting results back to the OTP team to make it better in the long run, which is what is going on in major ways right now. And there's been a lot of work done into memory contention and how the memory allocation works in the VM to be as lock-free as possible. Yep. And it's fairly interesting because the advantage you have is still that you have the advantage of choosing whether you want to do that or not. And if you do the traditional benchmarks, one of the old ones is always the ring benchmarks or the Chinese whispers, where set up a ring of processes and they send a message to each other. And disabling SMP on the Erlang virtual machine is always going to be faster for that benchmark than not having it, because there's always going to be a single process that runs at a time. And you're always much better to do it on a single core than just partitioning that across multiple run queues and everything. So it really depends on the kind of load you have and the work you have to do.
I'm pretty sure the Erlang on Xen Ling virtual machine, we're having them on in the next month sometime.
Oh, great.
Set it up that they only run on a single core, and they assume that the hypervisor will take care of the multi-core thing.
I believe that's correct. Last time I spoke with them.
And there's also a new OS coming out. It's called, I think it was OSV. I saw it just came out like on a couple days ago, and yeah, I just got back online after being offline for 25 hours due to a Sukkot, the Jewish holiday. Basically, they sort of looked at Linux and said, Linux is designed to be a general purpose OS. If you're running a virtualized machine, you want to run JVM or whatever. I don't know if they support Erlang yet. I have to talk to them. And you don't really need the full complexity of a Linux kernel and the entire Linux runtime, which is, fairly heavy. So I think it's sort of a more general version of the same idea as what the Ling guys are doing, where, you're basically running a much simpler OS on top of the hypervisor with, under the assumption that basically an OS instance running on, if you're, running on, an EC2 type deal or, Rackspace equivalent, for many users, you almost don't need the OS, because you're basically just running an Erlang runtime or a Java runtime or a .NET runtime or whatever. And, you just have one runtime sitting on the machine doing everything. And, if you need another application running on, you just boot up another EC2 node. So why do you need the full overhead of Linux? And, I don't know whether this will actually work out in practice better than just doing it, with a Linux or BSD kernel, but it's certainly an interesting idea that bears exploration. And
absolutely.
Their website didn't say where they were located, but the names of the people all looked Israeli. So I'm betting they're here in Israel. I will try to get in touch with them, but this week is Sukkot here. By the way, we generally record these 3 weeks in advance. So just for those who are listening, wondering.
Got it.
So they're probably off with their families too, like the rest of, or something. So I will try.
Yeah, well, it's definitely a project I'll check into. I'm happy to share some of the work we did early on with FreeBSD, where we did a very similar thesis where we took FreeBSD down to the sort of the absolute skinniest. And you can get some pretty significant performance wins. Particularly when you think, as you said, if you're just running an Erlang VM or a JVM or Ruby or Ruby VM or whatever, you don't need a lot of the other stuff I think we can probably pick up a new line of conversation, because I think where I ended was a reasonable spot.
I'll just edit this back together.
very good.
In the post, it's fine. I do that any. I post edit all these.
Got it. Great.
So, cool. All right. So basically, yeah. You know, the idea is that there's certainly work going on with trying to just sort of strip down the OS under the theory that a lot of what was done 5 years ago with the OS is now being done with the hypervisor, and that
exactly. We don't. And I can confirm that is a great idea.
Yeah, and it's not saying that. Yeah, it's just a good idea.
Yep. Yeah, I wish I unfortunately don't have any numbers handy that I can share, but we did see some significant wins by doing that.
Well, unrelated, I was wondering if you had planned to extend a kind of offer you do at ConquerX on other platforms that are callback-based, so Twisted in Python, for example, or plenty of other frameworks that love doing things callback-based. That will be kind of equivalent to doing things in Node.js.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question. I appreciate that. We absolutely do plan to support more platforms over time. I don't have anything ready to announce yet, but like I said, Python and Twisted and Ruby and Java and .NET are obviously very obvious things to go after. Because again, maybe to clarify, it's not so much the callback based nature that's important to us. It's this whole notion of we put in a little bit of instrumentation code into either the VM itself or to your application. And then we try to help the developer make sense of what's going on. So it's that middle, it's that sort of semantic analysis of what's really happening in your program. You know, higher than a, higher level than the line by line in a function, but lower level than say, New Relic. So that's kind of our sweet spot of functionality.
Cool. So where are you guys located? Like, how long have you been in business? How many people you have and stuff like that?
So we are located in Kirkland, Washington, right next to Seattle.
Okay.
And we have been in business for about coming up on a year and a half now.
Cool.
So it's a fun team, and we're making tons of progress. Like I said, our products are relatively new in market, so we're moving fast. And we definitely welcome more usage, welcome feedback, and any requests people have for how we can make things better. We're happy to have that dialogue.
It seems like your web page is more about the Node.js side than the Erlang side. Maybe that's just because it's a bigger market for you guys.
Yes, it is. This is something we've wrestled with, and we've been sort of incrementally tuning over time. While we love Erlang for the brilliant work that Joe Armstrong and team have done, and all the contributions since. The practical reality is that our Node.js customer base is several orders of magnitude larger. And so when we do our click analysis and traffic analysis, it the site has gradually sort of organically tuned to be more Node.js focused.
Yeah. Well.
So one question I have related to that is how do you evaluate the kind of adoption you've had in your Erlang community? Like, do you feel that a lot of Erlang projects are approaching you, but the total amount of Erlang projects in the wild is not large enough to go there, or it's kind of a smaller kind of adoption that if you apply it to a bigger market like Node.js, then you're going to have that order of magnitude, even if few people total in the Node.js community buy it, end up doing?
We've been delighted with the reception we've gotten from the Erlang market. The folks we've worked with have been fabulous partners, fabulous early customers, and as we got started with Erlang, a lot of our early customers, they saw our stuff, in a very, very raw state. From a customer engagement standpoint, we've been delighted with Erlang. The big challenge is frankly the size of the market. Like we're saying, it's the Node.js community is growing phenomenally rapidly. So at some point in time, I shouldn't say at some point in time, but at the end of the day, we are a business, and so we've had to be mindful of where is the bulk of the activity happening.
Yeah, no, that entirely makes sense from a business perspective. It's obviously a good decision to make.
Yeah, you know, if you don't pay the if you don't pay your employees and pay the rent, you're not a business anymore.
Exactly. Then it becomes a hobby project.
And, you know, speaking as somebody who likes to get paid, I fully understand.
Yeah. So maybe on that spirit, you know, in full candor, we do tend to launch features in Node.js first these days. And so if anybody has a particular feature they'd like to see in Erlang, just let us know. The more feedback we get on how to prioritize our Erlang work, the better.
Quickly, is your backend written in Erlang, or what's it written in?
We have a mix of stuff. So think of our project as basically having three major portions to it. There's an awful lot of client-side JavaScript for all the visualizations and so forth that you see. So obviously all that is HTML5, JavaScript, and CSS3. Then each of the languages we support, which publicly we've released Erlang and Node.js, but we have others in the work. Obviously, those instrumentation modules are written in that native language. So our Erlang runtime is written in Erlang. And then our backend used to be all Erlang, but now it is a mix of... And then our backend is hosted in Amazon. This is where we do all of our cloud analytics. And this is now a mix of Node.js, Python, R, and R right now. So it's an interesting, R is wonderful, but the single threaded nature is driving me nuts. So we're
I can see that. Yeah, I use it for stuff that you know, we're small enough scale that just doesn't matter much. But
yeah, so our scale things are either Python or Node.js.
So
let's the back end.
The announcements. We got a couple conferences coming up. We're just going to close out. We got Erlang Factory Lights. There's three coming up that will be out after this. On October 16th, there will be in Berlin. Robert Verding and Joe Armstrong will be there with Steve Vinofsky, Pavlo Baron, and a bunch of others. The next week, 23rd of October, will be Tel Aviv. I'll be there along with Michael Snoyman, Svi Abraham, Andy Oram. Some other folks should be really good. November 23rd, a month later, will be Toronto. Fred, were you going to be at that one?
Toronto, I still have to check on a few things regarding whether I'm going to be there or not. And maybe by the time this gets made public as a podcast, I'll be announced or not. I don't know. But right now, yeah, I'm just back from the New York factory line. I'm catching up on work. So I've been pushing the conference aside for a while, but I have to get back to them really, really soon.
And then in the 3rd to 5th of December in London is Code Mesh. Which also looks really interesting. I've submitted a talk. I don't know if I'm going to be accepted or not. At least they haven't told me anything yet. So, yeah, those are upcoming conferences. There's probably other good stuff happening. If you know of other good stuff that's happening, feel free to drop me a line, and you know, we can announce it because you know, that's what we're there for. So, picks. Alex, you got anything good?
I've been struggling to think of anything better than the picture you just sent with the JavaScript, the good parts versus JavaScript definitive guide. So I'll go with that one.
Fred?
Yeah, so I have three of them. The first one is a link to, I mentioned a couple of podcasts ago, that I would be on an O'Reilly webcast, and the webcast is now out. You can watch it, you register for free, and they let you see the original format. It's about modern server application design with Erlang. I have had one recently that's about a Brewer Palettes, and these are design tools that when you are designing a chart or whatever, there's a set of colors that you can use that will fit well together. I find it fairly interesting. And at some point during the talk, during the podcast, we mentioned Erlang on Xen, and I've been contacted lately by the author of a library called LibErlang Widget that uses Erlang on Xen and gives you basically an Erlang shell that you can use from the browser. So if anybody's interested in writing tutorials or doing training with people or whatever with comments to try, that's usually a good way to do it without needing to install entire Erlang setup. Yeah, so every time you refresh the page, then it spawns a new VM instance for you with Erlang on Xen, and that's what you use.
I'll catch up with you later on that because I actually need that. So I don't have a lot right, you know, I found a book called Red Shirts. I heard about it a while ago. It's by John Scali. It's a science fiction novel kind of making fun of original Star Trek. Because if you, you know, watched old Star Trek, you'll know that, you know, every time they go down to an away team, the red shirt bites it. And this is sort of a spoof that where, you know, it's set on a United Federation of Planets type setting where the red shirts sort of, the ensigns sort of are comparing notes and realizing they're in trouble. And it's just, it's a light read, but it's really very funny. So, yeah.
I saw that in the bookstore. I'll have to pick that up then.
Yeah, I've been meaning to read it for a while, and we were over at a friend's house for lunch, and they had a copy, so she let me borrow it, so I spent the afternoon enjoying it. The other one is a movie that I'm planning to see next week, Knights of Badassdom. It's finally coming out after being sort of stuck in the Hollywood black hole for a couple of years, and it's basically about a bunch of live-action role players who summon a demon or something, and features a lot of good people, and it looks like it'll be a very silly but very fun thing. So, nothing at all technical-related this week. Kind of been on a, but yeah, it's, you know, a good thing because it's just, you know, silly and fun. It's got a thing. Coolness. All right, Alex, you said you had to go in a minute, so let's wrap this up.
Yes, I do. I do apologize. So, Zach and Fred, thank you both very, very much. This was a delightful conversation.
Thank you so much for coming.
And for all the readers, for all the listeners that made it to the end here, thank you very much for listening. Hope everybody found it useful and informative. And by all means, feel free to contact us for anything that you might need help with in either Erlang or Node.js. It's www.concurix.com.
And obviously, we'll have that in the show notes as well.
Awesome. All right.